Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that has nothing good to say about Alex Jones or InfoWars. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Canagie, sir.
Yeah, so that mic seemed like kind of an odd thing to say right off the bat, but as my former 24 Panels co-host Drew Jeffries discovered, for some godforsaken reason, apparently, I'm not sure what site was recommending, but apparently the idea was, if you liked our show, they thought you might like InfoWars, hosted by scumbag Alex Jones. And I've got to say, I was at a loss.
To be fair, Dave, I mean, some people have said that Jones is just performing. So it might not be that he's a scumbag. It's that he's an ironic and performative scumbag.
No, he's a scumbag. I don't care if he's being performative. Dude's a scumbag.
Well, exactly. It's one of those things where it's like, well, when the end result is the same, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So we will officially add this as, you know, sort of the motto of the show.
We're not Alex Jones.
And he's a scumbag.
Yes. Duncan Jones, maybe. Alex Jones, no.
I like Duncan Jones. I mean, I haven't watched Mute yet. I know a lot of people have not said nice things about that film. I'm still curious.
Let's see.
But you know what?
I saw Moon, and I liked it, but I feel like it's building up to, like, a twist that never comes. Like, it ends, and you're sort of like, huh, I guess that's all there was. And then I saw Source Code, which, it's so many of the things that I love about speculative fiction all in one pretty mediocre ball. You know, the idea that, like, we have magic story technology, but we also have to place a completely arbitrary limitation on it. I think the most unrealistic part is at the end where it shows Russell Peters can entertain a train full of people for more than 5 minutes. And didn't he direct the World of Warcraft movie?
He did. I haven't seen it. I also haven't played a Warcraft game.
I don't know anyone who has. Like, can you think of a major property of that size that was in development for so long to be released with zero fanfare? It's like the Anchorman 2 of mega-budget films.
To me, this is the thing about World of Warcraft, and I... You know what, and I feel like I'm going to get probably stomped on by fans for my assessment of it with absolutely zero experience of playing it, but it seems like generic fantasy template 101, which is great for if you're playing a game and you're inventing the narrative as you go, but once you translate that into film, I don't know how it's going to be anything more than generic fantasy template 101.
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, the first 45 minutes, all the characters are introduced and they're cobbled together from viewer suggestions. And then the second act of the film involves you traveling to a village where they have to rescue 5 of the villagers and then bring them back for a reward. And then the third act never happens because you decide to stop paying $11 a month for it.
That could be it. Like I said, I'll stick with, you know, Conan the Destroyer, because that's like, what, 90 minutes max in terms of a running time. And if I'm not mistaken, Warcraft probably runs like, what, 2.5 hours in length?
I don't know. I mean, when you're making something off an infinite narrative, I mean, like, There's a reason that we never got, like, an EverQuest or Ultima Online, the movie, you know? But it's also one of those recognizable properties that they could honestly have just put a new cover on My Dinner with Andre and people would have run out to go see it because, hey, World of Warcraft, I recognize that.
Yeah, except for the fact that they didn't end up actually running
out to go see it. Very valid point. Yeah. Speaking of movies that nobody else seems to have seen, what are we talking about this week, David?
Yeah, so last episode, I should say, because it's been a little bit more than a week, we were talking about a wonderful little movie called Farewell, My Lovely, starring one Robert Mitchum, and it was glorious. And Andrew, you decided that we were going to be moving from that film with Charlotte Rampling, to another film with Charlotte Rampling that is also technically a noir. That is 1987's Angel Heart. Mm-hmm.
She takes a rampling and keeps on trampling.
Yes.
I thought it would be interesting, though, because one of the dangers that we were sort of fearing when we were spitballing the idea for this podcast, as if that's a process that ever ended somehow, it's that, you know, we don't want this show to just be like disparate films week to week. You know, we have the connective thread, but it's also personally, I think, more interesting when there are these weird sort of mirrors and overlaps. And the idea of going from late 70s sort of neo-noir to 1987 noir slash or noir hyphen, I think would be interesting. Also, Angel Heart is one of those films I saw only for the first time maybe like 5 years ago, but it's made quite the impression on me ever since.
You're not alone in that. I've seen this film within pretty much the same time frame. And I will say this, my first time watching this was, you know, when it was around midnight on a Saturday and said, hey, I don't have to get up tomorrow. What could possibly go wrong watching this film, you know, at this time of night? And folks, let me tell you, don't do that. Don't do that if you want to sleep.
I think I made the same mistake as well, because my partner at the time was big into Mickey Rourke, but didn't believe that there was a time where Mickey Rourke was handsome. And then I'm like, fine, I've heard good things about this movie. And any film that ends with a child ominously pointing with cat eye lenses, I'm like, okay, well, it's going to be a good long time since I fall asleep.
Yeah.
Did I tell the story about looking up the weird baby from Passion of the Christ at 3 o'clock in the morning?
You didn't.
Okay. But... yeah. I mean, Violet, I never seem to learn my lesson when it comes to looking up creepy children in the dead hours of night. So I think Angel Heart was my first taste of getting my feet wet in that regard. But we've looked at noir of a fashion, and I mean, again, we're looking at noir of a fashion again. It'll be interesting to see when we can actually go back to like the 1940s, the 1950s, the heyday of it. But here in Angel Heart, we have a film that, it really does straddle a couple different lines. Because again, with noir as a sensibility more than a genre, that certainly applies. Like, it's gritty, it follows some PI tropes, but it's also, it's half of this film is very bright. There's a lot of outdoor and day scenes. There's hot jazz on the soundtrack. So noir doesn't really seem to fit, but you can consider it a mystery because nominally it's a detective film, but that doesn't really seem to fit. You can call it a horror film, but that also doesn't quite seem to fit. So, really, I think this film can only be understood as sort of like this hybrid that shuffles through and overlays these different modes to tell its story.
Yeah, and we should, and I will say this right up front, even though, you know, I think it's been traditional for every episode we've done so far. Spoilers ahead if you haven't seen this film, because there's no way to talk about this movie in the nitty-gritty details without spoiling it. So
let's maybe restate that. If you haven't seen the movie we're talking about before we talk about it, just skip the episode. I mean, if you haven't seen any film that we've discussed, it makes more sense to just do it. That way you can point out how very, very poorly we're keeping on track with talking about what actually happens in a film.
Unless it's something like, say, Street Fighter, because I don't think we can spoil a film like that. But...
that's true. And the interesting thing about spoilers, I mean, before we even describe the plot, part of why Angel Heart was kind of on the forefront of my mind when looking for films to watch way back when was I had heard, oh, this film also has a really amazing twist. Now, maybe as part of the meta conversation, Dave, what do you think of when you hear the word twist ending or plot twist?
It's my immediate response is usually dread, only because so much of what we consider a twist in contemporary filmmaking and what people, it feels super snobbish to say, you know, the people, but there is a general audience for who that and the initial sense of surprise with the twist ending is what they seek out and is what they get the joy out of. And to me, while they're certainly, you know, fun to be found there, usually I just don't care because typically, like, let's take, for example, The Prime Suspect, The Sixth Sense. There's a twist ending that, putting aside that personally, it's easy to see coming early on. It doesn't add, I mean, there's nothing to really be gained in revisiting the movie other than, oh, there's another clue. Like, there's nothing thematically that adds to that movie. Nothing that makes it a richer experience.
That's a case where, like, the twist kind of relegates the film to sort of one-and-done status. Yeah, I think, and sort of just to clarify for those at home, if for some reason you decide to jump on this week, David and I, we were both film students. Film theory, we don't know how to make them, but we're great at picking them apart. But when, if you study film for 4 years, you're encouraged to look at films in a different way. And that's not to say that it's better or any worse than, you know, sort of the average moviegoer. It's just we're encouraged to use different vocabulary, look for different things, and that's why we sort of evaluate things a bit more structurally. And, like, you got to admit, if you think back to the first time you saw The Sixth Sense, assuming nobody spoiled it for you, like, that is a pretty impactful moment where it's like, whoa, I had no idea. And, yeah. I mean, there's certainly a value of having the rug pulled out from under you. Other famous ones, and here's where spoilers aplenty, Tyler Durden not being real in Fight Club.
Yes.
Or, you know, what's another? The Usual Suspects. But that, I mean, with Fight Club kind of gets away with it. Usual Suspects and films of its ilk, the problem with those twists is that not only did they not really add anything to the narrative, but in the case of, like, The Usual Suspects, it actively negates the entire film that we have seen to that point. Like, by the time that we realize, oh, he's actually Kaiser Soze and the entire story he told the agent was all a construction, we're like, oh, so we just watched 2 hours of, like, somebody's fantasy and none of that may have actually happened.
I see. Not to get a sidetrack too far off the boat, because I think The Usual Suspects will be a film worth revisiting, because I feel a little bit differently to you from that, although I can personally, I can see why you would have that reading of it. I can see why some people might come down on it. I think it's more nuanced than that, but I would certainly say in the case of something like Fight Club, to go with you on that one, yeah, no, I think with that case, that is an instance where the quote-unquote twist of the film, first of all, the film's not dependent upon that twist. Like, it works. I mean, even if you took that out of it, structurally, it still works for the most part on its own. It's just, I mean, you could conceivably see the film working even if it was Tyler Durden was a real person that our narrator is dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, because it isn't, it adds some rich nuance in terms of how we choose to interpret the individuals, how we choose to interpret the protagonist's understanding of masculinity as he sees it, if he has a singular construction of it. I mean, there's all sorts of layers that you can take away from. Not to mention, you know, in the case of that one, the way in which Fincher plays with the revelation through the cinematic apparatus is, in and of itself, I think, worthy of exploration itself.
Like, Fight Club is not a film that's predicated on its twist, I guess. And what we saw, especially after The Sixth Sense, is you have movies like, oh, what was it? The Perfect Stranger with Halle Berry and Bruce Willis, where, like, all the marketing and all the trailers were like, Halle Berry, Bruce Willis, you won't believe the twist. And it's like, you're actually marketing films around the fact that there's a twist ending. That tells you the only notable thing about this film is a twist ending. And it gets to the point where it's like, films are being made just so there can be that reversal. And I think the real litmus test is the question of plausibility. And whether or not, when that reveal is made, if the diegesis of the film still makes sense. And I think that's why Angel Heart maybe looked back on fondly, because it is a very startling revelation that we'll get into, but it's also one that does not, like, the way the story is told, it's completely plausible, and everything about the diegesis more or less seems to make sense both before and after it.
Well, and the key thing is I guess the major thing to think about is it, does it even really count as a twist? Because I know that that was the reception of it, at the time as a twist ending, but I keep looking back on it now, and in many ways, the film only makes sense if that's the only way this film really works. It seems like an inevitable trajectory in terms of the way the film's going to go, with what it is. And I guess it's, I mean, we should probably get into what the plot of the film is anyways for those, at this point. So, we're not sounding like we're being obtuse here, but.
So Angel Heart, 1987. Yes. So the film concerns Mickey Rourke, who's a hardscrabble private eye, hairy angel in the 1950s.
I think it's supposed to be 55, 56. It's basically 12 years after the end of the war.
Yeah. And given the signposting that they do, it's not too far away from it, but after the end of the Second World War. So, and Harry, who admittedly says, like, he's a small-time guy, handles insurance cases, spousal split-ups and things like that, he gets a phone call from a high-powered lawyer and an equally high-powered client, Louis Cypher, played by, in a special appearance by, Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And Cypher tasks him with tracking down a former singer, Johnny Favorite, who disappeared sometime during the war, and he's trying to track him down because they made a deal, he has something that belongs to him, and Cypher refuses to have unsettled accounts on his books.
Yeah, and if that sounds like a pretty typical noir setup for a detective film, yeah, it is. I mean, there's nothing that we've just described that would be out of place in a noir. And of course, there ends up being, you know, in the parlance of the time, a couple of dames involved, and other that, of course, Harry becomes involved with as he works his way through the case. And on that level, yeah, I mean, if you really want to call this a straight-up noir, you theoretically could, but this is the thing about it, because should we basically spoil the latter half, do you think, at this point, Andrew, just so we can put all our cards on the table?
Yeah, we may as well. Yeah. We've teased enough.
So basically, yeah, Harry pursues this investigation, trying to find, is it Famous or Favorite? Favorite? Okay.
Did I say Famous?
I thought it was... No, you said Favorite. I thought it was Famous, but...
No, maybe I'm wrong. As part of the abortive late 90s swing revival, there was also Johnny Favorite Swing Orchestra from Canada's Own. They had that terrible Root Beer and Licorice song. You don't remember that?
I don't. I liked the swing revival, but
I did not own a copy of the Brian Setzer Orchestra's "Dirty Boogie." I was actually reflecting on that this morning.
Yeah. No. I mean, they were. Yeah. I mean, Setzer's the one everybody goes to. But having said that, I was always partial to the Royal Crown Review. But
they're the thinking man's squirrel nut zippers.
Yeah. I guess. But we digress. Anyway, so basically Harry proceeds to pull this investigation, and initially, you know, after discovering that there was a cover-up involving an individual who was in a mental, or not a mental hospital, sorry, who was in a institution for long-term care who's missing, it seems to have been part of a cover-up for this Johnny Favorite to change his identity. Harry goes looking into this thing, and it keeps coming across individuals with either slightly occult trappings about their about themselves, or
nothing slight about cutting a chicken's throat and then dousing yourself in it while doing Santeria in front of a bonfire.
Yeah, what we ultimately come to discover as Harry pursues the investigation, you know, with additional prompting by Cypher with a significant monetary bonus for completing the task, is ultimately that Johnny Favorite was somebody who, around the time the war took place, he pretty much took a soldier, a young draftee, and then performed a ritual to cut him open, remove his beating heart, and eat it as a way to, more or less, I guess, steal his soul, or at the very least, as we would call it today, identity theft.
of a different form, yes.
Yes.
Can I give the plot the Grant Morrison All-Star Superman treatment?
By all means.
Private Eye seeks Singer. Singer into rituals. Singer stole new identity. Deal with devil. Private Eye is Singer.
Yeah. So basically, it turns out that, you know, after this ritual, Johnny ended up getting drafted into the war. And I'm not the film's not entirely clear whether he got drafted under the Harry Angel identity or under the Johnny Famous or Favorite identity.
Okay. Come to that by the end, though, because that is something that I think is a little bit weird. I have my own thoughts on that. But yeah, by the time the film is over, we realize that all the dead bodies that just happened to be piling up around Harry, it's the result of him actually murdering them in like a fugue state. He reveals that... believe it or not, the name Louis Cypher is actually Lucifer, and that Harry and Johnny are the same person.
Yeah, and the ultimate, you know, to make the ending extremely shocking, and probably one of the bigger controversies, which we'll return to late in the film, it turns out that Johnny had a daughter, played by Lisa Bonet, in this film, who... her name is Epiphany Proudfoot.
And, great name.
You know, yeah, great name. And at some point, you know, Harry and her consummate their not exactly a relationship, but at least infatuation with one another.
They have some pretty nightmarish sex near the film's climax, pun fully intended.
Yes. And ultimately, of course, this is Harry puts the pieces together. He realizes that she's actually his daughter, and the film concludes with him racing back to his hotel following a confrontation with Louis Cypher to discover that presumably Louis, based upon the shots we've seen, has graphically murdered her, which the police there to arrest Harry is responsible for the case, which Harry being, you know, having recognized everything that's happened, has pretty much accepted that that's his fate there. And the film therefore ends with possibly one of the single best ending credit sequences any movie has had. But
oh, yes. We'll get there. Oh, yes, yeah, we will. Yeah. But yeah, so there's a lot going on in this film. Its plot is kind of complicated, and stylistically, it does seem very much at odds with a lot of noir trappings. So, I mean, I think you're definitely right where the plot itself is familiar in terms of its overall structure, though. We have the down-on-his-luck PI who's drawn into a case with some powerful players and ends up way over his head. I mean, I think the stakes and the consequences of it are very unique to this film. And
yes.
Let me ask you something, though, because in Farewell, My Lovely, we see the Philip Marlowe archetype of the Private Eye. And yeah, as a character, he's built up to have certain traits. And, you know, the motif of, the fallen knight is one of them, where he's a guy who's down on his luck, the world's grounding down, but there's a sense of nobility about him. So no matter what he does, we always identify with Marlowe. We're always rooting for him. And my question, Dave, to you is... does this film do the same things in terms of identification?
Not exactly. Because, I mean, it's a weird thing. Because the thing about it is, as played by Mickey Rourke, Harry Angel is... he's an affable figure. I mean, I'll put it this way. You're kind of like him from the minute you meet him. Because he just seems... there's a very blue-collar aspect to him. That probably even more so than, say, Robert Mitchum's take on... Philip Marlowe, for example, where, I mean, he's very clearly a star in this role, no matter how worn down and beat down. Rourke may have been a star, but there's something very working class about the approach he has, and there's little touches they make that make you sort of appreciate him. Because, again, like a subtle little thing is the fact that Harry Angel wears glasses throughout the film. You'll see him pull them out in order to look over things. That little touch that, you know, traditionally you're not going to see with a major star in their vanity in place.
And I love them trying to ugly up for an acting award.
Yeah, exactly. And in this instance, I mean, there's a lot of little touches where you see, you know, Harry's pretty blunt and matter of fact. It's like, you know, he doesn't want to get involved in cases of murder. He just wants, you know, to do his job, get done, doesn't want to be involved in any of the creepy stuff. And, you know, there are little details where, yeah, you sympathize with him. At the same time, bit by bit, as the film goes forward, you do find things that are always a little off
about him. Like when he shakes down the doctor, for instance, I think might be the first indication of that. Because, yeah, at the very beginning, like, especially the whole conversation with the lawyer, he very much, like, comes off as humble. He downplays, like, he basically is saying, I don't want to get involved into anything too big. And when he's trying to think of why they even asked him, he's like, oh, right, it's because my name's near the front of the phone book, right? And, like, he almost, like, disavows that he has been selected to be put into this situation. And, like, as we later learn, there's nothing accidental about him being chosen. But yeah, like the second that, you know, his first lead, the doctor at the hospital that Johnny stayed in, signed him out for a payoff, he also discovers that the doctor is a morphine addict, and like he immediately starts putting the screws to him. He breaks into his house, like locks him in a room, so he goes through withdrawal and like sweats him down for info. To the point where it becomes pretty hard to be like, well, he's just getting results, right? It's like, he seems to take, like, a certain kind of pleasure in it.
Well, and that's the thing. And as the film goes forward, there are little details and odds and ends that, you know, sort of start compiling with there. Like the fact that, you know, when he goes to visit Charlotte Rampling's Crusoe, you know, he's pretty upfront about how kind of sleazy he is at that point in time, or when he finds Epiphany for the first time as he goes out to visit her mother's grave. There's a leering quality to him that is very, very unsettling, particularly when you consider that Lisa Bonet, when they're filming this film, she's got to be like 18, 19 when they're making this. And that, which, you know, Mickey Rourke isn't, you know, the old Mickey Rourke that we know.
He's not a broken down piece of meat.
Yeah, no, at this point in time, he, you know, this is Mickey Rourke, who's still, like, about a solid 20 years her senior, probably, at this point in time. And, yeah, there is something really uncomfortable where you get the sense of, okay, there is this, he's not as likable as he seems. He's not as down-to-earth as he seems. And there are things that he, again, you know, he comes across the doctor's body. You know, again, as a contrast, take a look what happens with Marlowe when the first murder happens with Moose in that film. Marlowe calls the police and, you know, sticks around, and even though he gives them a hard time, you know, he's trying to make sure that people know what's taken place, what's happened, and, you know, make sure that everything's on the up and up. Once he comes across the doctor's body after returning, having, you know, as far as he knows at the time, left him to sweat it out, he proceeds to cover up his presence there. He doesn't inform anybody. He wipes down the banister and everything else in order to remove any of his fingerprints and evidence that he was there. Like, he is just a little... He is somebody who's just who's looking out for number one, in a way. And it's interesting with the way the film plays with that likability versus our growing awareness that there's something wrong with this guy, particularly once we obviously get to the climactic revelations.
Well, if I may, though, Dave, I think the idea, I mean, we already brought up the idea of performativity. I think that's kind of interesting because Harry as a character, like, you know, it's not an accident that the fake name in the film, half of it is Cypher. You know, the idea of a code of some kind. And in some ways, Harry himself operates as a sort of cipher, because his last name is Angel. That's somewhat ironic and becomes very ironic by the end. But he's also a character that we know literally nothing about, especially as the film begins and as he presents himself. And, like, I almost got the sense that with the Doctor, like, he's putting on the strong arm act. And by the time he comes back and finds the body and sort of realizes his own culpability in that, like, he immediately retreats, he wipes down everything frantically, and he basically bolts. Because I think that's the moment when he realizes, I read it as, uh-oh, me performing as, like, the movie character Private Eye, that got somebody killed, I'm in over my head, and I have no idea what to do now. And I think moments like that underscore that there is a sort of performative element to what Harry Angel does. And again, like on a more meta level of the text, by the film's conclusion, we realize that Harry Angel is a performance.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think part and parcel, I mean, just to open this up and bring it back a level, I think this idea of him performing the Private Eye speaks in part to, I think, the tonal shift that this movie has from something like, say, Farewell, My Lovely, or the classic noirs, or even a lot of the neo-noirs of the time. Because when this, typically, you know, as we were sort of describing in the last episode, part of the point of noir is it was always a more cynical, you know, downtrodden, bitter mode or genre, whatever you want to phrase it as, going into it. And that sort of reflected the idea of post-war, corruption, a recognition of, you know, how terrible things are. But as we've pointed out, you know, repeatedly, you know, our protagonists, and often in these stories, there is either something noble about them, or at least something that humanizes them and gives a degree of optimism. Maybe even taking a look at something like Robert Mitchum's role in Out of the Past, one of the best bloody noirs you will ever see. You know, there's a sacrifice made towards the end of that movie, which is, you know, fits within the sort of Hollywood redemptive arc, as it were. And Angel Heart, from like the opening frames, does not have that.
How does this film open, Dave?
The film opens up with this beautiful but utterly haunting shot or sequence where we're, you know, in an alleyway. We don't know where we are. It's very, you know, disorienting in terms of how little information we're giving. And all it is basically at the end of this alleyway, we find a couple dogs who come across this mutilated corpse. And we have this shot, there's a beautiful shot, I think that it's the one that caps off the sequence, where you basically see the moon shining down on the body. But it's not like anybody finds it. Nothing happens. In fact, this thing gets, you know, forgotten about.
Yeah, it's acontextual, like, in a giallo film, for instance, like, this would be the first body they find, and then the next scene is like, there's a killer on the loose, they found another in the alley. Whereas in this film, like, it's just there, and it's not addressed, and it's not noticed. And I think you're right, that certainly echoes with larger themes in noir and larger themes in this film. And the idea of open institutional corruption, I think that's something, you know, like in the 1940s, it has a very different context from, you know, deploying it in the 1980s, the kind of ideas that you're trying to illustrate as duplicitous. But in Angel Heart, like, we see sort of high society itself is infiltrated by occultism. The church itself, especially in the New York scenes with, what's the priest's name?
Oh, I'm trying to remember what it is. It is, let me go back and look it up. But yeah, no, this openly corrupt priest, who, like, the first scene we see him, you know, there's been, if I remember correctly, is a suicide in his quasi-chapel. I mean, I'm not even sure how to describe the building, because it doesn't look like it looks like a church that's been set up inside of a larger structure.
Yeah, there's a lot of play with space in this film, and I think it's deliberately configured to be disorienting. And the church is the first real indicator of that, because it seems like the big recital hall where everyone's in the stands, and he's, you know, we have the classic preacher man screaming about how people think that it's sinful that, you know, you gave me all this money and I drive a Mercedes. Well, I think if you really love me, I'd be driving a Rolls Royce, and everyone just cheers for it. And then,
yeah
Angel goes Pastor upstairs. John. Yeah. Pastor John?
Yeah.
And then he just looks in a side room and someone matter-of-factly is like, oh, one of the parishioners shot himself in the head. And everybody just blinks and moves on.
Yeah, and I mean, later on, we come back and see Pastor John later. There's this really weird sequence where Harry comes back to the church for reasons. And number one, finds what appears to be, I'm assuming it's supposed to be voodoo material, located in, like, the back offices. But you have Pastor John, who's being raised on this parade by his parishioners. Like, he is some sort of messiah-esque figure, which is weird and kind of creepy.
Yeah. And the people are more than happy to hoist him up and give him that reverence he wants.
Yeah, and I mean, it's part and parcel where, I mean, in terms of not only the cinematic space, not only is it disorienting, I mean, one of the things that becomes very clear very soon is there is no safe space, there is no safe people to be around in this film. Like, again, Harry Angel is the closest thing we have, and as, again, we find out by the end, boy, are we wrong to think that. But, I mean, yeah, it's not like, you know, Marla, there's not the one good cop that he can turn around to. Like, there's not the, you know, one innocent in this whole situation that really comes out of it looking good. This is just a world of corrupt people. And ultimately, given what we sort of come to discover, I think you could, I don't mean this literally, but you could honestly make an argument that the whole film is taking place in a sort of, you know, hell on earth, as it were. Like, this is not, I mean, this is a place of the damned.
Well, yeah, it takes the noir trapping of, like, the sin within institutions, and then it just takes it to its logical conclusion, where it's not just that these places are sinful, it's that they are actively in conjunction with Satan himself. And, yeah, like, all the characters that we're introduced to, there is that weird play of sympathies. Like, you know, Saphir, for instance, you know, there's a distinct aura of menace about him, especially as his fingernails get longer and longer. Even prior to finding out who he really is, you know, he's charming, but there's always this sense of threat about him. Charlotte Rampling as Margaret, you know, she comes across as, you know, debonair, a sophisticated woman. And then we also discover that, no, she's pretty heavy into the occult. Toot Sweet, one of my favorite, this film has two of my favorite character names ever. Toot Sweet, the old bandmate of Johnny's. You know, yeah. We first see him just like playing some nice Delta blues on stage and talking about how all he wants out of the world is two citrus cocktails. But then we discover that, nope, he is fully immersed within like voodoo and Hangen practice. And even Epiphany, you know, she comes off as like perhaps the most innocent character in the film, but then we also realize that, nope, she is basically a priestess in the local, I don't know, chapter or whatever of Santeria, and, like, she's open and pretty upfront and even proud of the fact that, well, under the right of Chevalier, she basically got impregnated by the gods, and she doesn't seem at all concerned about that. And, I mean, the whole time, Angel, he's very much a passerby to all of this. He has that same Marlowe sense of detachment, for the most part, where it's like, huh, far out. But yeah, with himself as well, we also discover that he has secrets of his own that are even secrets to he himself.
Well, yeah, and I mean, think part of it and parcel is, I mean, even though he's detached, he is very much intrigued by this world as he goes through it. I mean, he's certainly not, I mean, there is something that is appealing to him, hence, you know, part of his, you know, his enrapturement with Epiphany, as we'll later discover. But it's such a very disturbing world. And I think one of the things to sort of maybe we should address here is we keep referring to voodoo, which in and of itself does have actual cultural significance. And I guess there is a way in which this film could be read as potentially racist in that regard, because race ends up playing a very significant component in this film. I mean, much of what's going on in this movie is taking place in which we would consider marginalized areas. Or, I mean, we're in Harlem, we're in the New Orleans, we're in the more impoverished things or areas. And the way in which, you know, it presents things like voodoo, it's... I feel... It's very weird.
There's a sort of bifurcation, I guess. Almost like the TV show Weeds, where there almost seems to be a very different presentation and a different attitude towards wealthy whites dabbling in Satanism versus poor and marginalized black individuals practicing not necessarily Satanism, but like non-normative forms of religion. And... you know, it's I can certainly see why sort of that division could lead to a very racialized, like hierarchical reading of this film. But I think given the film's presentation of morality in that, the way I read it is more is that, well, the subaltern has a lot more in common with those who disavow the subaltern than they think. Like, in terms of beliefs and practices, there's really no difference between the Proudfoots and the Kruismarks.
True.
And I think the film is sort of showing that, well, beneath every veneer, there's always that undercurrent of rot or impropriety. I mean, I don't want to discount entirely the fact that, well, I mean, this film is also notable for an explicit interracial sex scene in 1987, which is something that they couldn't have gotten away with in the 1940s. And I mean, I think it's not an accident that the two main regions presented in the film are Harlem and New Orleans, which are, again, very, very racially codified regions. But I also feel like, given what the film is doing in terms of sympathies and the stories it's telling, I don't know, like, I certainly wouldn't say that this is a film making a conscious statement about race, or if it does, that's peripheral to a different point the film is trying to make. Now, that doesn't mean that the film can't be racially problematic, mind you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. And, I mean, it's interesting because you get things such as when we discover Kruismark's father late in the film, who basically drops all the pieces into place for Hart, or for Harry, as to what's going on. You know, there's a point where he tries to claim that he, you know, initially at first, that he plays off how his daughter got involved in all the occult stuff as being a result of black servants that he had in his house, which Harry calls him out on as being ridiculous. And that's the thing. I mean, there's the way in which, again, this, you know, this again ends up happening, the way in which the police are explicitly racist in New Orleans early on in the film, and basically, you know, how they treat the murder of Toot Sweet compared to how they treat Harry compared to other crimes. That's notable. It's certainly not a case where, you know, racism isn't recognized. It just ends up becoming a question of, is this a film that's openly criticizing it and yet completely unaware of its own... it's complicit in a way?
Yeah.
And that's, again, I don't know where to sort of go with that because I'm not sure.
Yeah, I feel like honestly, how to... maybe... it doesn't strike me as a film that's terribly interested in neither condoning nor condemning. I think it's just presented as sort of like, okay, well, intolerance and bigotry, I mean, that's just kind of part and parcel of the world. And in a sense, like, the cops being racist, well, it makes sense, seeing as the film is concerned with the idea of, like, institutional corruption. Going back to Ethan Kruismark, I think it's also very significant that first, he denies, like, his own involvement in Margaret becoming fascinated with the occult, but then he's forced to admit that, no, it began with me. It starts with the father, right? It's, yeah, it's just, like, and that's, I think, all of the sort of play with identification and sympathies, I think that really crystallizes in the film's reveal. Because, first off, like, I don't want to spend, like, the entire episode talking about the reveal, but so many things come together in that moment. Like, the play of identification, like, normally we would feel bad for Harry, and especially by the end of the film, we realize he has been duped all along. There was never a way out. Because from the moment that he's contacted by Winesap at the very beginning of the film, and he meets Lewis Cipher, like, his fate is already sealed. You know, there's nothing he can do, and that the film's investigation, it's not him discovering the truth to lead to any kind of catharsis or any kind of happy ending for anyone. Him solving the mystery is him also recognizing his own damnation. But at the same time, every time we're tempted to feel bad, and it's hard not to, especially that sort of climactic conversation between Lewis and Harry. Harry is like, he sounds so utterly defeated, but like his voice is hushed. He's practically in tears, and he's just insisting that no, this wasn't me. This couldn't have been me. But there's this resignation about it. It's hard not to feel sympathy for, but we're reminded time and time again that Johnny Favorite is an evil man. He's killed people. He dabbles in the occult. Apparently he conjured Satan himself. And, you know, even Epiphany describes this man, her father, as the most evil man that her mother had ever met. And so we realize that, oh, well, you know, we feel bad for him in one sense, but we also know that he deserves it, but justice is done, but we don't feel any sense of relief about that. So the film leaves us, like, with this knot of interconnected sympathies that we can't really resolve neatly.
Well, and it's the thing, I mean, to get into sort of even the metaphysical, as it were, the sort of spiritual element of it, is the film, what Johnny did, this again, identity theft through souls, stealing, ostensibly, you know, is Harry, and again, the fact that he forgets that he's Johnny Favorite, or due to this head injury that occurred during the war, the question becomes, you know, is there any, is Harry Angel an actual person? Is there still an element of him in there? And ultimately, when we come to our, you know, the climactic credits sequence, where, again, one of the motifs you'll see throughout this film is an old school iron elevator that sort of randomly is interjected at points throughout the film. And ultimately, the ending credit sequence is Harry having recognized that he's going to hell. We just see him enter this elevator as it descends. You know, this ostensibly ARB symbolic gesture towards him going to hell, as it were. And masterfully edited and scored at that point, we should point.
And then it's right after the credits finish, we have that final shot of the elevator coming to a close. And I didn't realize this until I looked at it again, and then I basically over-revved the volume right through my headphones. Do you notice that there is a tiny bit of dialogue right at the end?
I didn't notice it at first. I was flicking through other comments, however, and I did. Somebody had mentioned it about this idea that apparently the names Johnny and Harry are whispered by possibly De Niro's Louis Cipher over there. Can you confirm one way or the other if that is indeed the case?
Yes, he very, very quietly whispers for both Harry and Johnny to, like, come here. And I think that also complicates the idea of, well, is Harry innocent, and is he being punished for somebody else's transgressions? I mean, in the same way that you can read Epiphany as being punished for her, for, you know, her mother and father's transgressions. Margaret is being punished for Johnny's own and her father's own. Like, there's this weird shifting of guilt and blame, and so, you know, even as it's revealed, like, when people start turning up dead, it's like, well, they're all pretty awful people, but are they evil, or are they just flawed and misguided? And by the film's end, it's like, well, it really doesn't matter, because the devil's going to come and he's going to take what's due.
Yeah, no, and that's just it. I mean, you get to the ending of this movie, and I mean, it's honestly very nihilistic in its sort of attitudes, because this is a film, legitimately, there is no hope. There is no, you're not going to get a redemption. Nobody's going to get out of this thing. I mean, even the friggin' baby, toddler, at the end of this movie, who, you know, like, again, you know, it never even occurred to me to read it as being, the son of Satan, as it were. But I mean, no matter how you choose to look at it, you know, this kid with this accusing eyes, either, I want to almost say, maybe I'm wrong, it almost looks like they've been superimposed over his eyes, as opposed to being contacts. I could be wrong about this. If anybody knows,
Would have observed, but I was too busy peeking through my fingers. Like the reason I think like this child could literally be the child of Satan is that there's that conversation that Epiphany and Harry have where she talks about the Chevalier and like the practice of, it sounds like you go into a somnambulist state and you basically copulate with gods. And that's when Mickey Rourke's all like, yeah, I heard of that Chevrolet. I don't know why he suddenly sounds like that.
You're mistaking it for Andrew Dice Clay, Andrew. They're very different people.
There once was a woman who copulated with Satan. Now our podcast will never be on MTV. But so I think you can literally read the child as the child of Satan. But I think even if you don't take that literal reading, like the symbol, it's a creepy and powerful one of like sin being perpetuated and like him having to face, like he faces his judgment in the form of a child that sits there and just points accusingly. And I think that's another aspect of the film that is really reinforced by its aesthetics. The motif of inescapability and sort of containment, because there's this weird, like, gridded architecture, especially in the New York sequences, where there are many shots of Harry through bars or framed from above him, like in staircases or elevators. And that recurring shot, no matter where they seem to go, there's a circular fan that doesn't seem to be working.
Yeah, no, it's rotating, but it's not fast enough to necessarily be generating any sort of comfort, or, you know, helping air, as it were.
Yeah,
or, you know, wind.
It's something in a state of breakdown. It's no longer providing comfort, but it's also a closed circle. There's no way out of it. And I'm pretty sure that most of the fans are also caged in some way. So, I mean, that as a recurring image certainly speaks volumes for the film's own motifs. And again, that sort of reinforces the idea where on the plot level, everything that happens is ordained to happen by the time the film begins.
Yeah. Well, it also speaks in part and parcel, I mean, to come back to sort of the post-war Americana, you know, aspects of film noir as a genre or mode, this idea of the inherent corruption in the country and how, you know, how it fails to live up to its promises. There is very much a way in which contemporary, you know, modernity itself is, you know, again, to come back to the idea of, you know, we're already in hell from the start of this movie, not literally, but, you know, modernity is hell, as it were. It is, you know, something that captures you. We never get to see, like, there's no sequence where, you know, it becomes a Sam Raimi film and, you know, the pits of hell open up and Lucifer is shown in this, you know, crazy demonic form. In fact, he even mocks that notion when he's talking to Harry first. It's like, would you believe it if I showed up in cloven hooves and, you know, in horns? Which, like, is,
well, Mephistopheles is such a mouthful in Manhattan.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, hell is, you know, the supernatural evil is very, very subtle in this film as in how it is portrayed, which is infinitely more disturbing, I would find, than any sort of grandiose presentation that they could have done, or effects heavy, you know, hellscape, because it would be so easy to see this film remade where suddenly Harry's, you know, getting pulled down by friggin' demons.
Yeah, or even compare it to sort of a more contemporaneous film like Jacob's Ladder, for instance.
Yes.
Where, you know, it's sort of similar terrain where it's the instability of the protagonist. It's not totally clear if it's real, if it's heaven, if it's hell. But, you know, midway through the film, Macaulay Culkin gives way to actual demons, you know? And then the film kind of takes a turn for there. Whereas, like, part of what's effective about this film is that it sustains the question of, is there something supernatural going on, or is Harry simply dealing with people who genuinely believe there's something supernatural going on?
Yeah. And, yo, sorry, no, I didn't mean to cut you off.
There it is again, Dave. No, I think that's an interesting tension that the film plays with, because, you know, Harry certainly doesn't seem to have much stock for ritualized behavior or belief in the underworld and things like that, but he has to reconcile with people are turning up dead because others genuinely do believe it. And, you know, I think part of his disbelief at the end when he has that confrontation with Lewis is that, no, this is real, and I'm actually at the center of it, and of all the people who should have known about the validity of Satan, for instance, I should have been the one.
Yeah. Well, exactly, and I mean, I think it's notable that the most quote-unquote supernatural elements that we see in these films are these, again, perhaps fugue sakes, but certainly it's these weird, you know, abstract sequences such as the notorious, infamous sex scene towards the end of this film, which is, as you described, nightmarish in its construction, where we seem to be oscillating between what's actually happening, which in and of itself is this really, as performed by Benet and Rourke, is almost, you know, animalistic, I guess is the best way to phrase it.
No, that's not wrong. Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Lisa Bonet fired from The Cosby Show in the aftermath of this film's release? Because too risque for, kind of feels quaint looking back at it now, but too risque for the quaint, wholesome image of Cosby.
I can't remember whether it was before or after, but certainly it was related to this film's production and her involvement in it. And to say the least, I think she can look back and openly give the middle finger to Cosby with no shame whatsoever.
Yeah. Don't worry. Lisa Bonet turned out just fine.
Which is why we're all going to High Fidelity after this. No, we're not. But at any rate, carrying on.
Animalistic sex, nightmarish imagery. But they both, converge in a way where it's not entirely clear what order of reality this is occurring within.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, particularly in that sequence, we come out of it and it seems to have mostly been symbolic, as it were. But, you know, there is something, you know, again, there's a way in which maybe you could read that in considering the ultimate duality of Harry and Johnny. You know, are we seeing Johnny's thoughts, his feelings, what he wants to act out? What is this a symbolic recognition of the violation and lines that have been crossed unknowingly at this point? And I mean, it does make for an interesting thing, because that sequence plays, it's creepy to watch it right off the bat. Once, you know, after you recognize the first time you've watched the film, though, and you come to the big reveal.
Yeah, it takes on a very different layer of meaning as well, because we are literally watching passionate incest.
Well, exactly, and it becomes this really, I mean, it's in much the same way that a film like Old Boy, probably its most comparable film in terms of that reveal, you know, how it plays with the audience's complicity in watching the sequence. And again, I mean, in some ways, I guess you could almost look at what Alan Parker does with the sequence as maybe underscoring that too much and saying, no, there's something's wrong here. Something is awful here, which maybe would have been more impactful if he didn't go down that road. I don't know. It's certainly open for interpretation and not what we're here to judge, but.
Well, I mean, it's strange. And in the same way that, like, as we talked about, last episode with film noir, the idea is that so much of it is based off expressionism, German expressionism. Yeah. And, you know, in the classic, like, probably the writ large example is like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where, you know, it turns out we have an institution that's corrupt and the madman is leading the asylum, and it's all canted angles and bizarre, impossible architecture. And all of that reveals that there's something fundamentally off about what's happening. And I think Angel Heart does, it takes the same idea, but it sort of frees it from like that particular, that uniquely Germanic sensibility, I guess. And we see it with like the weird configurations of New York architecture. We see it with these odd stylistic choices to all of a sudden have like a dream, nightmare, fantasy in the middle of what's, I mean, to most people would probably be the selling point of the film. And there are these very peculiar choices. Some of them like have a pretty obvious, like superficial and literal meaning, the elevator descending, for instance. But here, so much of the film's style is built to support those thematic points. And I think in that regard, it really, even though it's built very differently than classic noir, it still retains that same impulse.
Well, I guess this does bring it, because we haven't really mentioned Alan Parker, the director of this film, too much. And he's kind of a unique individual in this, in many regards, because probably, arguably, aside from this movie, you know, would we say The Wall is his most famous work?
Oh, yeah, he did direct that one. I was going to say that, realistically, David, you've probably seen many more of his films than I have. Let's see, Angela's Ashes, I read the book, didn't care for it. Life of David Gale, that's a film that does a twist ending wrong.
Let's hopefully not get to that one day.
But there's The Wall, which, I mean, it's almost like The Nightmare Before Christmas, where even though it's not a Tim Burton film, it's a Henry Selick film, which I love pointing out, it is a Tim Burton film in terms of its sensibilities and visuals. Like, Pink Floyd, or The Wall, is an Alan Parker film, but it's really more of a Gerald Scarfe film, right? Midnight Express, I know a lot of people love it, I've never seen it. And The Commitments, which is tonally as far from Angel Heart as you can probably get.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, Parker's not somebody that's easily categorized as a filmmaker, but I think certainly at this point in time in his career, because of things such as The Wall, he would have been classified as almost the quote-unquote MTV directors. And again, I've always had a problem with that as a sort of category, because often the people it's been applied to, it's been applied, I think, in a very unfair way. I mean, certainly Michael Mann got lambasted for that. Parker was lambasted. And I think in both of these instances, these are filmmakers who, you know, love or hate their films, they're not doing things without consideration. Like, this is not a case where I think you could say it's style over substance for the sake of having style. This is style as a result of the substance that's there, and choose how they choose to express it. And, you know, which is different from, say, I don't know, individuals such as, oh, who directed that Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake?
Marcus Nispel?
Yeah, like these individuals who are just like, you know, quick edit it, you know, just keep doing it.
Yeah, it's like we have a style that we're going to funnel the content through, whereas this is more, we have this incredibly crazy story. Can we think of a style to build off of that? And I think sometimes we do end up with like kind of a circular chicken and egg problem. Kind of ironic in the context of this film, given its emphasis on chickens and eggs. But yeah, like,
I do love that
there film. There feels like something a lot more organic about Parker's approach to this film. And I think maybe that might be owing more, I was just looking it up, director of photography on this one. It is Michael Sarrazin, who I'm not familiar with his work, but there's certainly some very innovative shot selection here.
Oh yeah, no, it's a gorgeous looking movie. I mean, I would certainly say I watched this in the on the Blu-ray edition, and if you can get your hands on it, folks, it's worth it, because this thing is just a feast for the eyes.
Yeah, like it's glossy and well composed, but it never gives way to anything I would consider like the MTV impulse. Like its style and its patterns of editing seem a lot more classically oriented up until like maybe the final third of the film, where there's a lot more sort of match on actions as Harry himself, like his psyche starts breaking down. He starts having visions of things that he did do, fears that he might have, memories of, you know, him being the soldier that's found out of a crowd, and it all starts coming together with rapidity. Prior to that, though, like this film, I don't want to say it's conventional, because again, there's some baffling shots there that work really well, but Yeah, like it certainly doesn't feel like anything belonging to like a film brat movement.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's one that's certainly aware of the history of noir, but it's not self-consciously evoking it in the same way that someone like, say, De Palma would do, or many other filmmakers. It's building off of what has been
Does
done before.
anybody evoke things as self-consciously as Brian De Palma?
I'll have to get back to you on that one because I feel like there's at least one who probably does, but it's escaping me at the moment.
Half credit for Tarantino. The problem is that he never actually cites his sources.
Fair enough. Boy, I had a thought there, completely slipping of the brain right at the moment.
That's Tarantino for you. But yeah, so this is a film that's like almost in a similar way as Farewell, My Lovely. Like it's a noir film that recognizes where it's come from and the foundation laid for it, but it's also not limited by that either. So it ends up everything that the film does like still works within that tone of noir, but it puts it in places that I don't think anybody would have ever imagined by the time that even like Kiss Me Deadly came out. You know, people are like, oh, you're gonna end a Private Eye film with an atomic bomb going off on a beach? Well, that's it. Genre's over. And it turns out, well, no, we can have a literal meeting with the devil, and that, you know, it's what would be the opposite of a Deus Ex Machina? This would be Lucifer Ex Machina, I guess.
Fair. Yeah, no, it definitely would make sense. But no, yeah, but you're not wrong. I mean, I think it's interesting because, I mean, there is something, it's unique that we haven't seen this blend of horror and noir, you know, repeated often, if at all, really, since this film came out. I'm
Would
trying to think if there's
seven maybe be the closest analog?
closest, but even that is more. It owes itself so much more, I think, to the serial killer genre, as it were, because it feels like such a different beast
Yeah.
of a film without the because there's no overtly supernatural aspect of it,
True.
although it's still nihilistic as can be.
Yeah. Maybe it's because it's a neo-noir more concerned with God and sin than it is concerned with Satanism in a strict sense. Though apparently there was a spec script leaked for a sequel to Seven called Eight, which involved the spirit of John Doe being transplanted into a new host.
Oh,
And apparently they
Jesus.
just decide to make like Exorcist 3 all over again. Yeah,
Which,
but
I mean.
it's what would the Exorcist 3, would that be an analog to Angel Heart?
That's a good question, because I mean, as anybody who listened to Cinema Chase knows, I love Exorcist 3 with a passion. I would say the difference, though. The thing about it is, I don't think William Peter Blatty evokes noir in the way he shoots that film. Like, there's nothing about, you know, the downtrodden detective that feels like it's a particularly noir take on that. Likewise, I mean, so much of the way in which it's shot, like, there's nothing, you know, where I feel like Blatty is evoking the past in that way, as it were. He's just, I mean. It's very interesting because yeah, I honestly never thought to look at those two films side by side,
I'm just trying to
in
think of
that.
like, yeah, any kind of supernatural noir. And I mean, honestly, Angel Heart, even yeah, a good 30 years after its release, it really does stand alone in a lot of respects. And for better or for worse, there basically is no other film that's quite like this one. You know, in terms of its hybridity, in terms of like it's just doubling down on nihilism, in terms of like that icky, unsettling feeling you have when the credits finish. Yeah, like there, as we talked about last week, there are certainly many different ways you can do neo-noir, the same way that there are many ways you can do noir. But I think like for some reason, just the parts came together in 1987 that produced this film, and it's the only one that's like it.
Well, and that's the thing, because there was talk at apparently at one point of they're doing a remake of his film, and I just don't see what the point would be. Because first of all, I mean, we never even mentioned that this is technically based on a novel that Parker adapted. I mean, he wrote the screenplay. I've never read the book.
I have not either.
Yeah, I've read bits and pieces about what Parker ostensibly changed, such as apparently the whole central twist was his innovation for the film. It wasn't from the original text. Certainly transplanting portions of it to New Orleans was apparently his. Again, I can't confirm that because I've not read the work. Maybe this is just misinformation that's leaked out onto the web.
Like how Good Morning Vietnam, you know, it's based off the life of Adrian Cronauer, and the only thing that actually corresponds is that there was a person named Adrian Cronauer.
Well, something like that, or, I mean, you know, like the misinformation that's been printed over the years about the Men in Black comics, because you will find all sorts of people detailing the quote-unquote, you know, original text of that book that does not actually correspond to what's there.
It's all fake news. Maybe we are more like Alex Jones than we thought.
God.
Oh, no. Just like Harry Angel, the monster's within us all this time.
Ugh, God.
Oh, wow. Well, honestly, Dave, I'm thinking that we can probably steer this to our patent-pending show-closing bumper segment.
Yeah.
Hits and pits.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, do you have a first hit for us, Andrew?
Let's see. I totally just had one. Okay, my hit of the film is that it's a twist ending done right, not only because, I mean, watching it again, I have hindsight bias, so to me, like, the early scenes really felt like it was telegraphing, like, to the point where it was impossible not to see that, you know, who Lewis is, and, like, just the allusions he's making to Harry himself. Like, it's still, when the twist happened, it's still impactful, and I think more than anything, it holds up logically, because even though we have all these complicated details about, oh, well, Johnny got plastic surgery, and then he came home with amnesia and shell shock, and now no one knows what he looks like, all those details are there to give it that diegetic weight. So when he interviews Margaret later, who was his former lover, she does not recognize him. The people he's investigating, they know who he was, but they don't know who he is. And due to, like, the body switching and amnesia angle, there's a reason that Harry himself does not know. Because if there's one thing I hate, it's movies where, like, a person actually isn't who they say they are. And, like, there's the scene of them on their own investigating, and then they discover, like, a mysterious clue, and then they act scared and surprised. It's like, well, no. If you know all along that you are not who you say you are, why are you acting surprised? In case an audience might be watching you? This film avoids all of those trappings because it tells its story in a way that the twist works, you know? It pulls the rug right out from under you, and at no point does it rupture the diegesis surrounding it. So for that, I'm going to give it a hit.
Yeah. On my end, I'll give it a hit as well for something much less sophisticated than you're noting here. A cheap pun done right. And in this instance, Louis Cipher cracking a hard-boiled egg in front of Harry Angel. It is a super cheap visual pun, but I will take it.
Well, especially when I was talking about, you know, some people think the egg represents the soul, and then taking a huge bite out of it.
Yeah.
It's like, I wonder what he's trying to get at there.
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, it could be groan-inducing in any other case, but the way in which the film, I mean, again, it's hard to look at the Louis Cipher stuff as a twist when... Again, I mean, his entire identity is based on cheap puns in this movie. There's nothing subtle about what they do, and yet, it still works, as it were, if only because I don't think what goes on with Louis Cipher is meant to play as a twist per se. The stuff with Harry and who he turns out to be, perhaps. Who Louis Cipher is, I'm not so sure. I think it's very much a case of the film sort of straight up acknowledging it right from the get-go. But
well, yeah,
that's my take.
It's
on it.
And consequently, like, I think that's why the ending can be read as tragic in a certain way, because it's not that Harry is found out. It's not that he is caught and has to admit everything. It's that he genuinely does not know who he is. And the film is his investigation coming to that realization, and sort of, it almost becomes a very sick punchline in a sense. And I think playing off of some of the film's puns, visual and verbal, like, this is a darkly comic film, but it just never hits the way that I think it, not that it intends to, but it hits a different nerve than the one you're expecting. Yeah. Let's see. What would another hit be? I think the soundtrack is pretty awesome. It's just very of its period, but I think it's integrated pretty well, even though it does have Dr. John on the soundtrack, and I really don't care for Dr. John. it's a 1980s film that's got the hog jazz that feels very of its time and of its place, used for decent effect. Let's see, I'm trying to think anything else I've gone over. How about you, Dave? Any other hits?
Honestly, looking over it, I mean, it's just a subtle nod to one other actor we haven't really mentioned here, and that's Dan Florek, who shows up.
Friend of the show, Dan Florek.
Yeah, who, you know, it took me a minute to recognize. It's like, okay, I know I've seen him somewhere else. Where do I know him from? And yeah, it's Law and Order SVU's Dan Florek.
And straight up Law and Order, no?
Yeah, that's right. He was in the original show as well. That is true.
I will say, in 1987, there were so many shots early on where I forgot it was him, and I thought it was Stephen Tobolowsky.
He does have that Tobolowsky look to him, doesn't he, at that point? He really is. I mean, it's a small role, and just the way he plays off of De Niro in his scenes, it's not like there's a ton for him to do, but, you know, he commits to what he needs to do, and he does it well. And it's hard not to appreciate that.
Well, it's also interesting because, you know, he's Herman Weinsapp, this prestigious lawyer, but he's sitting in the room with Satan as his client, and he seems to know that. Like, he doesn't come off as being duped or held against his will. Like, he seems fully okay with it. And, I mean, there's, again, the obvious jokes about, oh, well, the lawyer's totally okay having Satan for a client. But this is the way it plays out. Like, again, he's sort of on the periphery, but him being there, like, just sort of smiling from the side, there's that underscoring of, like, something just a little bit menacing about all their interactions.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, there's my second hit there, thing. Any last hit for you, Andrew, before we move on?
I think special mention to Lisa Bonet, considering how young she was when she took this role on, considering her status in pop culture at the time of its making, like, and considering the constraints of the role that she plays in this film. Like, I think it's a pretty audacious career move, and obviously, like, there were consequences of that, but I think she plays Epiphany in a very interesting way, where, again, like, there is that tension between her coming off as, like, an innocent young girl, or, like, she's the one light in this film where everything else is corrupted, but then we also realize, no, she is a woman with her own desires, and she is well aware of communing with Satan, you know, and she's totally okay with that, and she likes the power that it gives her. So in a sense, like, it's something beyond the femme fatale, you know, where it's not that she's born evil necessarily, it's that she makes that choice. And I think it gives the character a very interesting aura to her. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it does speak, I think, to one of the interesting things about this film is there is a point later on when Margaret's father is babbling on about, you know, their involvement in the occult in raising Satan, where he talks about the idea, you know, of this power that protects him and all these things. And everybody in this film is ultimately presented as a dupe because they all die. Like, nobody's actually protected from anything over this thing. And you're right, it's all by choice. Like, they knowingly get into bed, pun not intended, with this individual. And it comes back and bites them all horrifically. And they seem to be completely oblivious and keep on, you know, believing that, yeah, no, everything's gonna work out okay for us in some way, shape, or form. Or in the case of Johnny, thinking you're smart enough to somehow pull one over on the devil, as it were. And no, you're not. So, I mean, there's almost something sort of satiric, I would say, about the film's presentation of the occult and people's belief in what it can and will do for them, because it really doesn't, at the end of the day, in any way, shape, or form. So, kudos, I guess, for a very subtle form of commentary.
Yeah. I guess on the flip side of the hits, we have our trademark pits as well. Just minor gripes with the film or anything that we haven't brought up earlier. I can think of maybe one. And that's the scene where Epiphany and the chicken, you know, watch the film, you'll know what I mean. It keeps having these cutaway shots to Toot Sweet, played by Brandy McGee, who must be the least rhythmic maraca player I have ever seen in my life. It just keeps going to these cutaway shots, and it looks so ridiculous because he's, like, completely disinterested and, like, sulkily shaking maracas. It's, like, I think it's possibly replaces the cutaways to Everett Sloan during the Charles Kane song sequence.
Oh.
Where, like, his mouth is just open and he's staring ahead and goes, I think we have a new version of that for our generation in the form of Toot Sweet playing maracas. What about you, Dave?
It's a tricky one because it's not, like, this film is so tightly constructed and so well made that it's kind of hard to sort of pick out anything that's a real overt problem, as it were. I would say this is such a minor nitpick because I don't know if it really even counts as a nitpick so much as it is. Maybe I'm just missing something. But throughout the film, we see Harry has these visions of the woman in the black veil, or at least what we assume to be the woman in the black veil. And, you know, right at the end, we see that it is indeed Lucifer sitting outside the bedroom there. And again, it's not a problem. I mean, and in fact, seeing De Niro in that is the big reveal is kind of actually, there is something creepy about it. But does it ultimately add anything to this film that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise from it? I honestly don't know. Like, I really don't see if there is a thematic or, you know, subtextual point it's really making. In the film. What about you? I mean, do you see anything to that, or?
I think it would speak to maybe a bigger gripe of when so much of the film seems like formally and aesthetically unified around a particular theme, that there are these weird, like, extraneous details that the film comes back to enough that it suggests there's something there, but it doesn't have nearly the same level of clarity as the rest of it. And I'm thinking in particular, the repeated shots of chickens and Harry talking about how he does not like them. And I'm thinking that there's a connection there to be had with the egg as a soul. Chickens produce eggs. Harry's worried about, he's afraid of souls, I guess. Or maybe because they remind him of what he traded for his fame or something like that. But instead, like, it just comes off at first as, like, a weird ad lib or, like, a gag throwaway line, but then they keep coming back to it, but they never really explicate it. And I think that just might be filed under, you know, it just feels strange where, again, when you have sort of the core themes of the film that are, everything in the film hinges around them, to have these weird extraneous bits just feels kind of strange.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, there might be something maybe we're missing, and maybe, you know, I probably should have given Alan Parker's audio commentary track a playthrough.
Though also, to be fair, Dave works two jobs, and I just got through my exam week. So, you know, even for film students, we're allowed to be inattentive audiences, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, are there... the other thing I would point out, Charlotte Rampling, I like her a lot, and this is too... She is the point of connection, after all. And I think the reason we've had so little to say about her is that she doesn't really have much to do in this film. I think there's two scenes that she's in, and one of them she's dead. And I mean, just like Farewell My Lovely, like she's in it enough to be interesting, but there's not enough for her to really turn out a bravura performance, which is a shame because, you know, whether you look more recently at, like, Swimming Pool, or even Life During Wartime, she has a very brief role, probably about as much screen time as Angel Heart, but she's given a lot more to do in terms of emoting, in terms of acting, and in terms of, like, overall significance. So it's just a shame when, you know, the people who are capable of heavy lifting aren't given the chance to do that. Compare that to, say, De Niro, who's not in the film very much. He's given, like, the special appearance credit, but he makes every single scene that he's in count.
Well, yeah, now this is De Niro, you know, back when he was in fighting shape. I mean, this is him really giving this performance his all without going over the top.
Yeah, before he had his own hoo-ah moments.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, yeah, I agree with you about Rampling here. I would almost suspect that maybe she took the role as a excuse to work with Alan Parker. Because, I mean, again, if I'm not mistaken, he had Birdie as well before this there. But, you know, at least in the case of something like, say, in the case when she was in Farewell, My Lovely, she was an up-and-coming actor at the time. So you can look at it and say, well, yeah, her role doesn't require much for her yet because she's still at that stage of building up her credits, where by 1987, Rampling was a known quantity. You know, you knew her presence and what she could do and, you know, whether to make how you can make use of her. And yeah, it does feel like kind of a waste to have her in this role and then not do anything with it. But I think that's about the grand total of any sort of, you know, problems.
Well, yeah. And when there's so much going on in the film, I mean, you know, our only complaints are like, yeah, this film doesn't do everything perfectly, as opposed to anything being like outright and egregiously like wrong about it or anything that just undermines the film. And I mean, like, just looking at the time code now, I realize we've gotten quite a bit of mileage just talking without even arguing like we normally do. And I think that's a testament to just how rich this film is as a text. And, like, even going back and watching it, like, I mean, I knew the story beats, but watching it and sort of, like, paying more attention to aesthetics and editing, you know, you realize, like, this is a film that does sustain repeat viewings.
Oh, yeah, no, easily. And I think that's, again, a testament to the fact that this is not a film dependent upon its twist. This is works as solid drama, first and foremost, without question. And, you know, it's worth seeking out. And you know what? It occurs to me, maybe there is another film thematically. I mean, I would maybe might count as a sort of horror noir.
All right, try me. Is Brimstone it Blackula?
No.
Is it Scream Blackula Scream?
No, those are both awesome movies, but no. Well, okay, they're interesting movies. I'm not awesome is probably putting it too far. But, no, I was going to say Brimstone and Treacle, written by Dennis Potter, made in, I want to say, is it 83? I think that one comes out.
I love how you're asking me to verify that. What is Brimstone and Treacle?
It is a film starring Sting as an individual who may or may not be a demon who works his way into a family where you have an elderly father who's works at a greeting card company, and his wife, who they have a daughter who years earlier sustained an injury that has left her basically in a catatonic state. They're stuck looking after her, and Sting shows up claiming to be her long-lost boyfriend that they broke up just shortly before, the tragic incident that led to this. And I will say no more, because people, if you haven't seen Brimstone and Treacle, do yourself a favor.
All right.
Brimstone and Treacle.
Looks like I'm
awesome.
Going to the public library tomorrow and crossing my fingers. And yeah. If they don't have that, well, I realize I can get a copy of Tower Heist.
Yeah. Boom.
Yeah, so much for preserving the arts.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that about wraps up our tour all the way, our nonstop ride from New York State to swampy Louisiana. And
yeah.
Well, I guess, David, you got the wheel for this one. So where is our film strip going to take us next?
Well, you know what I was thinking, Andrew, is... You
what
know,
were you thinking, looking, Dave?
We were looking at the last few episodes we did. We've talked about Dead Man, which is an amazing movie. We took a look at Farewell, My Lovely, which is an amazing movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we've took a look now just at Angel Heart, which is an amazing movie. You know what we haven't done recently?
What haven't we done recently?
Looked at crap.
We looked at Where the Buffalo Roam 4 weeks ago.
Like I said, that might be the case, but we've had a 3-film streak. I think it's time to break it. So we're going to be following...
what are you doing to me, David? What are you doing?
We're following composer Trevor Jones from 1987 to 2003 to discuss the one, the only, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, starring Sean Connery. So... Look for that soon.
Yeah. Poll quote. That was the worst movie I've ever seen. Andrew's dad.
Yeah. So, is it really, though? Tune in and find out. We all know what Alan Moore thinks, but...
You mean the original author?
Yeah. No, he's actually credited on this one.
This is probably why he started getting his name taken off.
It probably was, but to be fair, and I'm sure we'll get into this next episode, I increasingly have less patience for Alan Moore and his whininess about these sorts of things. But again, I don't want to spoil things too soon, so tune in it for the next time on that one. So any final words, thoughts, or things you want to say, Andrew, before we take off?
I'm just saying that I really hope I can find a copy of LXG somewhere, because, bargain bins clear out in a hurry in my neighborhood, and I can't remember if they've slated that one for a Criterion collection yet.
I can't assure you that that has not happened.
All right. Well, Dave, it's nice to know that this is how you repay me for Farewell, My Lovely. And Angel Heart. I'm just saying that karma's a wheel and, well, payback comes to us all. If there's anything we learned from Lewis Cipher.
Yes. So until next time, you can find me on Twitter at 24Panels.
And you can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper.
Exactly. So, yeah, we'll be back in a little while with the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And until then, take it away, Andrew.
Remember on this journey, adventure might scare you, but monotony will kill you. Finally remembered it.
Hooray!
Yay!
Goodbye, folks.